everyone. Welcome to another podcast of Criminal Justice Cafe. Today, I would like to introduce you all to John Lowry. And I like to say, right, Dr. John Lowry. Is that true? Yes.
It is. I have the student loans to prove it.
It's true. I've had the pleasure of being in John's class at Albertus Magnus. And he is currently the interim chair of sociology and the director of the criminal justice programs there. He has also done many, many years, and I'll let him talk a little bit more about that, as a correctional officer and also as a unit manager here in Connecticut State Prisons. So I think we have a great perspective, alternate perspective, you may say, on different sides of the way the system is. So this is a great segue for our listeners to learn a little bit more about my cause and what I like. So John, welcome. Or should I say Jay? What do you
prefer? You can say Jay. That's Jay's. Okay. I prefer. That's fine.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you very much. You know, as you said, I am currently the interim chair of sociology at Albertus Magnus College. I also oversee our criminal justice programs. I've been in Albertus since 2014. And prior to that, I retired, as you said, from the Connecticut Department of Correction, where I did my 20 years from 1993 to 2013 at McDougal Correctional Institution in Suffield, which is the largest general population maximum security facility in New England. For my first 10 years, I was an officer. I was what's called a treatment officer. I was a classification counselor. And then for my last 10, I was a supervisor at the rank of unit manager. So I had some very unique experiences working with that population. And, it's allowed me to transition into academia and at least have a moderate level of credibility as to what I speak about.
You think? That's a lot behind your belt. A lot. I have to say, I have learned a tremendous amount in your classes.
Thank you.
Coming from my experience, because I was inside incarcerated, I mean, in a federal camp, which is very different from your experiences, I thought I knew a lot more than I actually did on the technical and academia side. And taking classes and going back to school has been wonderful for me to be able to see both perspectives. Yes. And I have to say, I've changed a lot of my perspectives based on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, Albertus it's a wonderful institution. I was an adjunct since 2000. So for 14 years or so, I was an adjunct while I was working in the department, and I taught primarily at Westfield State University, Worcester State University, and Springfield College, all up in Massachusetts. And working in Albertus is very unique in that the demographic and the populations we serve are so different in those areas. And this is something we've spoken about before, but in my 7 years at Albertus, I have had, to the best of my knowledge, 27 students whose fathers and or brothers I knew personally as inmates at McDougal. So wow. I would see that, you know, so and you mentioned, you know, in class, we would talk about nature, nurture, why do some individuals, what are the reasons that individuals offend? And to see individuals from the same family, raised by the same parents, the same conditions, one doing a double life sentence at McDougal and one pulling a 4-0 at Albertus, working three jobs with a family. And I always, again, from an academic standpoint, I studied it, but to actually see it in real life it's a fascinating perspective.
It is. It's to me, I'm fascinated as well as the nurture and nature aspect of things coming from on the federal side. And I've seen the same exact thing. I know we have spoken about this specifically with the prison system. Is how do you take someone who you have this family dynamic, and you have a brother who happens to have done some very bad things in his life and he's gone to prison? Do you feel as if that's actually rehabilitative, or is it punishment, complete punishment?
And that's, again, so, you know, one of the things we talk about quite a bit is my personal kind of caution against working in absolutes. And one thing in particular, when it comes to the criminal justice system, one of the biggest issues I think we have specific to corrections is, what are the goals of punishment? What are we hoping to accomplish? And, to the point of, for most individuals, if you tell most individuals that you're going to be incarcerated in maximum security prison for 5 years if you do X, they're not going to do X. Or they may do X one time, experience that situation, never do it again. So to that point, our punishment has A, been a deterrent immediately the first time. And the second time it was through the fact that they actually had to offend to experience it. And most people, but again, the population I dealt with at McDougal was so atypical. I would say, I'm not sure how to quantify because I didn't take a poll, but based on my experience, I would say the majority of offenders I dealt with didn't see incarceration as a punishment, and oftentimes chose to be incarcerated. I tell the story about the first time the first inmate I had, he had a 25 year sentence. He was parole eligible after 18 years, and he was a model inmate. Never had a ticket, had a job, went to school, never got in trouble. Just a really good guy by all measures. And he was up for his parole here, and I'm like, hey Smitty, your parole hearing's coming up next week. He's like, just go ahead and cancel. I don't want it. I'm like, what are you talking about? I said, you can be on the street within 4 months. He's like, yeah. He goes, I don't want a PO hanging over my head. I don't want to get a job. I'll just finish my sentence here and walk out all with nothing. So theoretically, he chose to spend 7 more years in prison rather than face in his mind the responsibility of having to get a job and report to a parole officer and worry about getting caught up in something that he may or may not do. And I tell people that story, and a lot of them, think I'm lying, and I'm not, because it happened multiple times after. That wasn't the first time.
Yeah.
So, and again, I don't know if that's to our discussions. Does that speak more to the failure of our social systems, of our criminal justice system, of our general work ethic and personal responsibility? there's it touches a lot of things, and that's some of the struggles that I've always had.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks more to everything, if you think about it. It's the old, like the Shawshank Redemption, which our listeners, I'm sure, can all relate to Red. He's institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And so many of these men and women who go into prison, who get these lengthy, lengthy terms in prison, I mean, drugs with mandatory minimums way back when, and they don't know how to live in the real life. We had that conversation about a particular inmate who was 19 when he went in, and I recently received a letter from him at 43, and his penmanship is that of a 19-year-old. His letter writing was of a 19-year-old, and he's terrified that he's going to be getting out because he doesn't even know technology. He knows nothing about life, and he'll be out at 50 years old. And at 50 years old, what skills do you have? What skill set do you have to get a job?
That's absolutely. And one of the things, and I don't know if this is anything we discussed in the past, but McDougal was very unique in that we opened McDougal in 93. It was an absolute state-of-the-art facility. One of the primary components was the focus on rehabilitation and education specifically. We had an academic program, but we also had that what at the time, as I understood it, was the most state-of-the-art vocational education program for any school in Connecticut. Because as you're aware, the Connecticut DOC is USD1. It's its own unified school district. And the USD1 gives more GEDs than any other school district in the state. So the same facilities that they have at McDougal. So again, so McDougal is open, $160 million facility, whatever it was. 9 or 10 absolute state-of-the-art vocational education programs, while at the same time, the Hartford Public School System was taken over by the state because the conditions were so deplorable. So the irony here was, I would say the majority, I would say probably 60% of the inmates we have in Connecticut come from Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport. So three cities represent the overwhelming majority of our population. So you had inmates who were profiting from a vocational education program in a maximum security prison while their children were going to school in a public school system with asbestos tiles falling from the ceiling and textbooks that were 15 years old.
Wow.
So it was always kind of a, and there was a large outcry from the community about that. And the reality is, again, as it was explained to me, in 1993, the government came to Connecticut and said, we will give you $170 million to build a facility if you're interested. They didn't say we'll give you $170 million you can invest in the Hartford public school system.
Right.
Either you can build the prison or Tennessee's going to build the prison, to that effect.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened. And the second part to that, that always kind of troubled me, was that program was fantastic. In one of my capacities, I was the unit manager for IPOD. And IPOD was the voc ed block. So all the inmates that lived in IPOD went to voc ed, participate in these programs. And they were across the board. As a unit manager, I could have walked into IPOD in the morning, left the keys on the desk, and that block would have run itself with no issues, because it took so much time for inmates to get into voc ed. I would almost see nobody would ever do anything to kind of ruin it, because it was so difficult to get into.
But let me ask you something really quick. They're going into this program. It's kind of like me. I'm back in school. Educationally, I'm learning a lot, but there's no experience. So they're learning and they're getting their GEDs, but they're not applying what they're learning to life experience.
Exactly. So
the kids that are getting that education in these school systems that may, the syndrome box may be falling, they are, however, getting life experience using that education.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great point. And the other part that always bothered me about that was, so these, you know, they would complete these voc ed programs, whether it was electromechanical, electronics, woodworking, carpentry, cabin, and they were unbelievably skilled and talented workers. It would take between 2 to 3 years, and they would complete the program, and they had an amazing amount of pride and work ethic, and you could see it. I mean, these were guys that I saw every day. I saw them sometimes 7, 8, 9, 10 years waiting to get in. The progress they made, the development, the maturation, the acceptance, all these things that we're hoping to achieve through the concept of incarceration, they're meeting that. They complete the program, they get the certification, they go to graduation, they feel amazing about themselves, and they don't discharge for 35 more years. So by the time they leave, that certification is obsolete. So again, in a very selfish way, as an individual who worked in IPOD, that environment was a benefit for me because they behaved themselves to be there.
Right.
But in the long run, would it make more sense to have that at a Willard, a Cybulski, or a level two, so they could use that and immediately progress to the street?
Right, right. And do they have jobs? I know, like in federal prison, there's jobs. There was Unicor, there's a puppy program. The women in Danbury run the facility, both the men's and women's facility.
Yes.
Doing carpentry.
They do. I mean, but they're not a lot. There was a few private industry jobs. The majority of jobs were we call tiermen, basically inmate janitors, laundry workers, kitchen. We ran the statewide commissary out of McDougal. The average salary was 75 cents a day. If you're a laundry worker, you made $1.25. If you were able to get into private industries, there's a little bit more, but it was very limited.
Yeah.
So there, when you say jobs, not in the traditional sense, it got to the point where as a unit manager, I would hire tiermen, and I would have maybe 14 or 15 tiermen in a unit that I could function with two or three. And it just, for the sake of giving jobs, we gave jobs, but it certainly wasn't an 8-hour fulfilling, beneficial situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, for me, I couldn't imagine, I shouldn't say it's wasting an education. However, it would be like me getting my sociology degree and never researching or doing sociology at all. And that's a shame. And it's an injustice to the inmates, as well as it is to me, to society that has given the facility all this money to educate.
Exactly.
The inmates.
Yeah. And, you know, and another thing, another point to education. So, and I don't know if it's changed since I left, but I believe it was when I left in 2013, if an inmate was under the age of 25, by law, they had to go to school to get their high school diploma or GED if they didn't have it. And again, that sounds great, but that also creates some problems because oftentimes what happens, especially at McDougal, these individuals come in and they're facing these massive sentences. And they're young, 18, 19, 20 years old, 65, 70 life sentences. You're 4 or 5 years before you can even wrap your head around.
Yeah.
So what I saw a lot of times was older gentlemen, maybe in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, who have had a chance to process that, who never got their high school diplomas or GEDs, who were wrapped up in the game younger. And finally, whether it was the aging out process or just, you know, getting old, they want to change your life. So they wanted to go to school. The problem was MPOD was the school block. And they, at 40, 50, 60 years old, they didn't want to live with a bunch of 18, 19, 20 year old kids.
Yeah.
So it created a lot of conflicts with how we could offer. While I understand the rationale behind giving a younger individual their high school diploma or GED in that particular setting, given that dynamic, it may not benefit them yet. But for the 40, you know, for the older individual who's finally kind of come to terms with everything else, that's when. And again, I mean, I saw so many individuals completely turn their lives around and change their lives. And, you know, people would say, well, who cares? They're never getting out. And it's true. Yeah, they will never see the street. But their quality of life while they were incarcerated, impact they had is immeasurable.
Yeah.
One particular story, I won't use any names, but this particular person, they came out of Northern. They were a tremendous discipline issue, to put it mildly. It's like saying they have a receding hairline. They were problematic. And they were in Northern. They fought every day. And they got in Northern. He got to McDougal for whatever reason. He and I, and for no reason at all, other than the fact we both had daughters about the same age, we connected at that level as the father of a daughter. And we developed a rapport. And at the time, I was the public information officer, and I did discussion panels with inmates. So I brought him into the group, much to the concern of the administration. And he was fantastic. I mean, absolutely tremendous, dynamic. And he and I got to talking one day, and he said, "Law," he goes, "I'm the only guy you're ever going to meet that was born in a prison, and I will die in a prison."
Wow.
So his mom was at Niantic when he was born, and he was born at Niantic.
Wow.
And he got out, and you know, he went through the system, and he picked up a lengthy double life sentence, and he got double life without parole, and I think plus 45 years. So when he told me that, that's something that just to hear that, and again, I mean, I'll be honest, I'm a somewhat cynical individual. You kind of got to go somewhere to affect me emotionally like that, but it really did, and I saw the bigger societal issue. This kid was literally doomed from the beginning when, yeah, you know, when you start getting to the specifics of all of it. So yes, to the point earlier about, you know, what is the societal impact? How do we fix that? How do we address that? I have no idea. But I know that our prison system, as you know, is filled with individuals who have similar experiences. And that's,
I agree so much. And that's one of the reasons I started this podcast, is I'm not so much concerned about people who've been incarcerated, their stories. I'm more concerned about educating our communities, mm-hmm, on what the realities are. Having been there, I mean, I am in my 50s going back to school because we've talked about it. I have 3 kids, all have their master's degrees, and through watching them go through it, they didn't appreciate the education as much as I do. And even now, if I'm on, you know, I'll be on something and my daughter will say, "Mom, just Google it." And I'm like, "I don't want to Google it. I want to learn, actually learn what I." And I think when you get older, and I have changed my life completely, slowed it down. I appreciate experiences more than things. And I do believe, and I was incarcerated for only 7 months. I know women who have, and I told you this the other day, who've had sentences of 15 years. I have one woman who's got 30 years in prison for a white collar crime. Do I feel that everybody should be punished or should feel the impact of the weight that they created? I do. I needed that 7 months in prison. It changed my perspective on so many different things. So I'm not somebody who is a everybody should be free person. And I know a lot of my criminal justice advocates would hate me for saying that, but it's the truth. I don't believe in release everybody. Everybody should be free. I believe in rehabilitative and restorative justice. And I think that the communities have such a misconception. Women who I know who have come home from white collar crime, incarceration, cannot get jobs anywhere. Dunkin' Donuts will not hire you if you have a felony, a federal felony. And these are educated women that the recidivism rate is zero practically, almost. I mean, not quite, but they're not going to reoffend. And they needed a check on themselves. They needed to look at themselves in the mirror. I don't think that there's some women that don't take responsibility. I can't talk. I'm sure men too. I don't have a lot of patience for that, but I'll say it nice and politically correct. I have no patience for that, but I do believe that people do deserve a second chance if they've earned it.
Absolutely. And because you went there, I'll go there, and I will offend my pro-law enforcement supporters when I say that I absolutely agree that we have far too many people incarcerated, particularly for nonviolent drug offenses. And this is something we've talked about.
Yeah.
And this is my internal struggle as an academic versus a practitioner. From an academic standpoint, I realize that the sentencing guidelines are dramatically unfair in a lot of ways, and people are locked up for crimes they shouldn't be there. And I absolutely agree that they need to be released. Mm-hmm. Professionally, my situation was at McDougal, I had very few of those individuals. You know, mm-hmm. I had the individual, whenever you pick up the paper, see an article, the most heinous Cheshire, we can go through, like, those were the individuals I dealt with. So when we talk about second chances, no, those, you know, I don't feel that those individuals, the individuals that were on death row and had their sentences commuted, I don't necessarily feel that they need a second chance and should be released into society.
Right. So, because they've not earned it, yes.
Yeah, but there are people that will disagree, and I respect that. But again, my baseline for that is I have maintained relationships with many individuals who were formerly incarcerated. At last count, three of them, regrettably, had their sentences overturned because they were innocent. So they, all of them served more than 25 years in prison. I had them for about 15 to my entire 20 years. So through, and later they were found to be innocent and they were released, and we maintain contact and we talk. And these are the discussions we have. We talk about the inequities in the criminal justice system and sentencing. And even those individuals who have been that negatively affected by the system will say, but you remember so-and-so? I don't ever want to live next to that guy. So when you have people that can be that sort of objective after being wrongly convicted and sent to a maximum security prison for 25 years for a crime you didn't commit, again, it's that issue of working in absolutes. I think you have to, because there are people that need to be there. And that's just, in my opinion,
I agree. And I think one of my favorite things of having a former correctional officer and now a professor on is, I think correctional officers get a bad rap from criminal justice advocates. I really do. Being inside a federal prison, I had wonderful correctional officers, and there was some horrible ones.
Absolutely. So,
you know, walk me through a day of a supermax prison correctional officer and what you have to deal with on a daily basis.
It absolutely runs the gamut. One of the best ways to describe it, the job is 99% sheer boredom and 1% sheer terror. Yeah. I mean, you will be here all day, couple minor things, inmate homicide. Got to deal with that, or attempted homicide, or staff assault. So for an hour, everything goes crazy. You're running, you're responding, you're fighting, you're wrestling, you're exposed to blood. You have all these, and then it stops and it goes back to normal operations. And then it's another fight that stops. So there's no typical day other than the absolute chaos. And, also in a lot of ways, I mean, I missed it in a very kind of bizarre way. I missed the camaraderie. You know, there were a lot of inmates. I can't say that I would never say that I developed friendships, but you have a rapport. I mean, spent more time in general population housing units I spent with my family. I was working 6 or 7 doubles every 2 weeks. So you're there, and you know, you, there are certain individuals, you just, you know, this one individual we would, you know, we would talk about, you know, I'm a big Alabama football fan. So they like bands. We talk about that. Other inmates were involved in weightlifting. Some inmates were involved in art or music. So you just find different ways to connect. And the reality is, I would say, you know, 95% of inmates on a normal day just want to do their bid, be left alone and be safe. Just like same with officers.
Yeah.
And to your point, you know, I am unabashedly pro law enforcement. That's just who I am. But I will be the first to tell you that I worked with a lot of individuals that I feel had no business doing the job. You know, yeah. They weren't there for the right reasons. And the reality is because of that, because of their attitudes and their demeanor, they jeopardized my well-being. Because oftentimes what happens is when a correction officer gets assaulted, it's normally not the officer that the inmates are angry at. What happens is second shift transfers to third shift, and second shift officer has been riding the inmate all day about something. They lock them up, and then the inmate sit in their cell just fuming on it. So yeah. The first officer they see when that door pops is who they take it out. So again, you know, when it comes to individuals who shouldn't do the job, and that's why the segue to what I'm doing now with the education and the academic component. When I was working in the system, I came in with a bachelor's, but I got my master's and my doctorate while I was working the job. And for me, my escape was education. A lot of people I worked with had trades. They were plumbers, electricians, landscapers. So they would work the department to get their benefits. They retire in 20 years. And they were, you know, I have no marketable skill sets. I am a big fan of Angie's List because I can't fix anything. So for me, I fell into education. When I completed my master's, I immediately became an adjunct, knew that's what I wanted to do, and then started pursuing my doctorate my last 4 years. So the timing lined up. And I remember at the time, I was on a promotion list for deputy warden. I had tied for the highest score in the state. And I had an administrator tell me, we were friends, and he says, hey, he goes, I heard you're getting your doctorate. I said, yeah. He goes, that's fantastic. He goes, you know, we're not going to promote you, right? And I thought he was joking. I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, and his response was, in 2009, we don't want you smart. You know, we want you to follow a policy. And that was the mentality. I mean, there was very, one of the best things about my job at the time is the department paid, you know, my union paid for half my master's and a third of my doctorate through tuition reimbursement. Well, the reason there was so much money available in tuition reimbursement because nobody was going to school. Education was not emphasized. So my theory is if we want to have a more professional organization to truly have an impactful outcome on how individuals, offenders are going to leave that facility, the same way we advocate, and I'm a huge proponent of education for inmates as well, but I think it has to be reciprocal. I think you need to create that environment and nurture that environment on both sides of the wall in order to develop the kind of, again, professional environment that you want to have to best meet the needs of what was now our new corrections. It's not what it was in 93. So that's sort of how I got to where I am now.
I agree. I mean, what are your thoughts of prior inmates becoming correctional officers? I know that now, going back to school, trying to obtain my doctorate, I would love to work in Danbury in the federal prison, working with women, because I've been through it. I know what they're feeling. I know what they're thinking, but I could never get that job.
So that's a great question. And I don't know that I have a great answer. Again, theoretically, I'm being brutally honest. Theoretically, you are absolutely right. Nobody understands the mind of the offender like a former offender. Right. So from that perspective, I get it. But also having worked and the kind of the camaraderie and the brother, gender neutral brotherhood, whatever the correct term would be, you know, that you have
your brotherhood,
personhood, whatever. So no, but I don't know that they would be received by their peers and again, this is the sort of thing that correction, in my experience, in my opinion, corrections is at least 1 to 2 decades behind the rest of society. So while, you know, what is socially acceptable in free society, I think takes about 1 to 2 generations to catch up, just because the ingrained nature of what 20 years from now, if you were to ask me again, I may have a different opinion, but I think right now, I don't know that we're culturally at that point with the staff and the inmates as well, because the chance of manipulation, you would need to prove yourself so much more than other officers. Theoretically, it would be great.
I hate to say this, I actually do agree with you. I think that me going back into, now I've gone back there to speak a couple of times, I don't get the respect that an officer who has not been through it gets, because I have succeeded. I've gone through, I've come home, I've rebuilt, I've started over. And I think a lot of women that are incarcerated that I speak to feel it was easy for me. And it wasn't, it was very difficult. They don't know, because you're, and I do know what they're going through. And there is a sisterhood, a bond that you make with people that, I mean, the women that I met there are probably the most wonderful women that I've ever met in my life. And I don't think I have, this has been a large thing in the criminal justice advocacy world that people want to go back and they say, well, you need to have prior inmates as correctional officers. I really don't think that's an answer.
Having worked, and this is evolution, maturity, whatever. When I first started department in 1993, at 23 years old, it was a much different, we hadn't opened Northern yet. The gangs were running wide open. So for my first 3 or 4 years, it was sheer chaos. You were fighting all day, every day. And I'm sure you can relate, in correctional settings, you have custody and treatment. And custody, and this may offend some, custody always has to supersede, strictly because the goal is always safety and security. Mm-hmm. No matter, at the end of the day, no matter what we do, the Department of Corrections' primary responsibility is protecting the public. So custody will always supersede, in my humble opinion. However, I learned to develop a much greater appreciation for the treatment side as I went through my career. So to your point, I found the most effective individuals we had when it came to treatment and programming were former offenders, because they had that relatability, they had that street cred. And your point was great, but it's a different dynamic. When you come in as a volunteer or paid on the treatment side, generally speaking, the inmate population viewed you differently. My belief is, if you come in from the custody side, now you're trying to be them. You come in from treatment, you're one of us. Right. You go custody, you're one of them. And that's, in my opinion, that us and them mentality still exists. So that would be my concern about that dynamic. Again, 15, 20 years from now, that may be the norm, but I don't know that right now we're really there.
Yeah. Oh, true. I mean, I used to go in and speak to the psychologist. I love the psychologist at Danbury. I'd go in and talk to him every day. Mm-hmm. I created a job for myself as his secretary. And he kept saying, no, I don't have a, I don't have, and I said, yes, I am. And I used to take the whole thing, but I'd argue with him and I'd say to him, why am I talking to you? Because you are a correctional officer first, always. If something happens, you now are no longer a psychologist, you become a correctional officer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
However, if he was a psychologist who came in just for treatment, I would feel much differently. Sure. In speaking with him, because he was there. Yep. But his main job, he had his keys, he had his, that's what, if something, that's what he was first. And it interests me why either the Department of Corrections or the BOP doesn't bring in just treatment, because there isn't anybody that I know of in the BOP, I'm not sure about state, that commends, besides ministry work.
Sure.
Commends just for treatment.
I think one of the biggest reasons is, and I'm being speculative here, but it's based on, I think it's based on some level of understanding, is just staffing. People talk, prison staffing is very low. Like we always had issues with officers. So the way you offset that is you have correctional food services, you have correctional maintenance. And yes, they're food services, they're industries, they're not COs, they perform other duties. But if there's a code, those individuals that respond to assist the inmate. At McDougal, so there were two officers black. You had a control officer who was in a control center, they couldn't come out. And if I was the rover, I would be out in the block with 95 in. So I was outnumbered 95-1. So if something were to jump off, we have a limited number of uniformed correctional officers available to respond. So we need additional staff as well. So there's sort of double dip in a way that, you know, it's a correctional food services. Yeah, they're a food service officer, but they went through the academy, the same training. So they respond. And I think that's maybe why they do it. I mean, I know that in a lot, you know, oftentimes when you see disturbances or riots or anything like that, or maybe an inmate being assaulted, a lot of people will view those videos and be like, why did it take staff so long to respond? It took 5 minutes before staff got there. All the others, we don't have 45 officers sitting in a room like firefighters waiting for something to jump off. So if something happens and they're in another block, they have to secure that entire unit. They have to lock everybody up. And depending on the size of the compound, the main concourse in McDougal is just over a quarter mile long. So if one something happens in H pod and you're down in M, you have to lock every block, get everybody secured, make sure that unit is good, and then sprint a quarter mile down. And also, we need to keep a certain number of staff back, because what may happen is what they set off in H was a distraction because it's really going to go in M. So when everybody runs one way to respond, you know, it's a numbers game. So I think maybe that may be, to your point, why they do that is because we need as many, particularly on first and second shift, with the most amount of inmates around. So that's when you have the most amount of, you know, counselors and treatment and dent and everything else. And that may be the response.
Do you think that's going to change? Now, we talked about them closing Northern, the state of Connecticut, and having to send inmates other places. So now, did they also let go staff, or has that staff doubled in the facilities that they kept?
And again, so here's where it gets a little tricky and specific to corrections. And I don't want to speak like I am a expert on staffing issues, but one of the things that's happening in Connecticut is next, I believe it's 2022, they reopen CBAC, which is the collective bargaining agreement for unions. Okay. So what I anticipate is going to happen is, as I understand it, if you are a Connecticut state employee anywhere in the state, and you have enough time to retire before they open CBAC and possibly change what your retirement benefits will be, they're going to leave. I anticipate a large number of staff members leaving the state of Connecticut employment because of that. Having said that, budgets determine staffing. So oftentimes what will happen is they simply eliminate positions through attrition. Just because you may have 400 staff openings throughout the remaining facilities, and you may have 100 staff at Northern that may be redistributed, but they're simply backfilling positions that were already open. Right. And again, I am not human resources. This is just my view and my opinion. That's how I always kind of saw. I don't recall them ever creating additional CO staffing jobs. It was always backfill.
Yeah. And so now they're getting rid of Northern because we have less population in the state of Connecticut. Yes. Are they keeping I don't even know if it's still there, the Cheshire program. I know you were a little involved in that incredible
program.
It was a great program.
I'll be honest with you. I went about 6 or 8 months before COVID. Actually, I went there and I spoke to because many of the inmates went to the TRO program were the same guys that I had doing my programs with me at McDougal's. So that's how I knew these guys.
Yeah.
So I went to kind of see how it was going, and it was fantastic. I was a huge proponent. That was great. And then obviously COVID kind of came along with everything else. That's another area where I kind of lost touch. I don't have that answer. I hope so.
Yeah.
I think it really, and again, that's an opportunity for, the way I saw it, those types of individuals we talked about earlier who are never getting out, but because they truly changed their lives and made conscious decisions to behave differently, can have a positive impact on the next generation. So I am a huge proponent of the program and those similar, and I hope that it's able to continue and expand.
Well, yeah, because this is that's their life. I mean, you go into prison and that is your life, and it's nothing like the life outside. They're two completely different worlds, 100%. And I've done some global studies recently and looking at the prisons in Sweden, and a lot of people in the United States feel punishment, 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 and they get very angry when we have a prison that seems to be plush. I should say it's not, but appears to be plush to the community. And they think that the prisoners are getting too much, but if you look at these prisons in places like Sweden, the population is doing so much better as far as criminal justice than the United States. There's got to be something to be said for that.
There is. And again, just my personal opinion from the same type of research. When we talk, you know, I hear this a lot. Like, why can't we be more like Scandinavian nation? When you look at the demographics and population scan, they're so homogenous, and it's, you know, they don't, all the things that make, as far as I'm concerned, make America great, our diversity, our different cultures, our, you know, whatever your views are in capitalism, right? You know, we have such a diverse population in this country that you can't necessarily, Nordstrom. I forgot the name of the facility, but it's a maximum security facility, and it's built for 95 inmates. They have 95 inmates in the entire facility. I had 96 inmates in H1. So when you start your point is absolutely valid, but I caution against drawing parallels. You can't really compare them.
Yeah, you're right. It's like West Virginia versus Danbury for a women's camp. West Virginia, you have 700-800 women. In Danbury, when I was there, was 200. There's only 49 women there now. And the women that come from Danbury seem to excel a little bit more because the population is so much smaller, and they can do so much more.
And, you know, to one of the, you know, just one aspect in particular, you know, one of the things I did was, you know, in my former capacities, I did a lot of gang intel and work with the gang. You know, we had a huge gang program in Connecticut. And again, it's because of that diversity. You don't have that in Sweden. So you don't have to factor in who you can have, you know, who can get who housed together because of issues from the street or rival gangs or racial issues or any of those things. So, and again, it's also just the sheer numbers. As I said, whenever I saw, you know, he was a former warden from Attica, and he went over, and he toured, and he was, you could just see the look on it. Yeah. They had their housings were basically quads. Like, you'd have, you know, four bedrooms, shared bathroom and a kitchen, and they had cutlery, you know, knives, steak knives, butcher knives. And that was the norm. I don't know that you want to start incorporating that at McDougal. You know, I mean, I theoretically I get it, but having worked there, I still think, but again, right now, 10, 15 years, as I said, in my opinion, corrections is kind of the last thing. When we look at societal evolution and change, corrections is kind of one of the last ones to come along, just because everything is so, you know, I joked that when I started in 1993, we used to use a Polaroid camera for crime scene photos. I never learned how to use the internet because we never had it. If we had handwritten two form requests where the canary copy goes here, the yellow copy goes. So we, and that was in 93, which wasn't that long ago, but it just kind of shows how corrections was always very slow to catch up.
Yeah.
So 15
and 20. 2015, they're still doing the copies in the BOP.
Yeah. So well,
then, 11.
My response to 20 to 30 years. But I think that's, I would like to, I would truly love to see that be a possibility. But again, I'm skeptical only because of my personal experiences in that environment.
Okay. I'm going to flip the switch on you a little bit and go to the academia side.
Oh boy. Okay.
Only because I'm curious about this. I'm working with Professor Kendrick on my...
Yes.
Sociology. She's amazing.
Yes. Yes. Esteemed colleague of mine.
Oh, wonderful. One of the most fantastic professors. She takes time off on Saturdays because I do Saturday mornings down the Google rabbit hole that I am a little psycho about. And I have a
question. Balances.
Yeah, it's crazy. And one of the things I'm researching now is why in the United States, women are currently being incarcerated at a higher rate than men. In your opinion, it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. It's a trend that has been, I think in the last maybe 8 to 10 years, we started to see it. I know, is it still around 10%? Has it crept up much more than 10%?
It's crept up more than that. The last research I did, it was actually 14%.
Okay, so again, about 7 or 8, yeah. So 10 to 4. I don't know that. And again, so in just to full disclosure, I'm not as familiar with, so having worked in male facilities only and state only, I'm not as versed on the federal sentencing guidelines and females specific as I probably should. But in my limited research in the area, I think it's just a move towards greater punishments in general. I think everybody kind of got caught up in that umbrella. I know, and you may be able to speak to this, you know, better than I could. Again, I never worked in a female facility. And in my view, my belief was that I would say the overwhelming majority, high 90%, are there as a direct result of the actions of men. A lot of times they were often co-defendants, or a lot of times they were brought into it.
Conspiracy charges.
Is that, is, you know, and again, I'm looking at the state level. Is that necessarily the same? The federal may be a little bit different.
Yeah, it's a little different. I think, well, on the state level, you're looking more at violent crime, where most of federal is either drugs or white collar, because it's crossing state borders. Mm-hmm. And drugs are a lot of times related to a conspiracy charge based on a boyfriend or a husband, and they happen to be there. And the sad thing is most people don't understand that a conspiracy holds a greater sentence than if you actually committed the crime, which is a frustrating thing for me when I speak to some of these women that are in prison for 20, 30 years because their boyfriend was selling drugs or their husband was selling drugs out of their home. They knew about it and didn't do anything about it. And they are now in prison for a longer period of time than their husband who was selling drugs. It's shocking to me, actually. And when you bring kids into the play, as you said, if you have a parent that's incarcerated, the likelihood of you becoming incarcerated is so much higher.
Yeah. The number of intergenerational, again, real quick, I had maybe 3 months left to retire. I'm walking into concourse one day, somebody comes up, he's like, Laurie, he's talking to me. Looks so familiar. I know this guy. I looked at the name tag, Johnson, but that didn't know. So, and all of a sudden I go, you were in J-Pod in 97, right? He's like, no, that was my old man. He said, he heard I was getting locked up and came here, said to look you up. You were a good guy.
Wow.
So I was getting like Yelp reviews from, but, and I say,
nobody wants to mess with you because you're such a big guy.
Well, actually, this is one of the things I miss, and this may be relatable to you too. One of the things I miss most about the DOC is I was actually the skinny, good looking guy. Everybody I worked with was this, but big at 280 pounds. I was the little guy. That was a great place to be. Oh, but as I was talking to this inmate more, I remembered a situation where I knew him, was so familiar because I remember him when he was a kid in the visiting room. So I remember talking to this individual now as a 20-year-old, when we were talking, he was, I think, maybe 6 or 7. And it was so prevalent. I mean, just so many generations and families. And at one point in time, we had one family with 8 members. There were 3 brothers, a couple of nephews, some cousins. And it's sad. There's no other way to say it. It was also the reality of the situation.
Yeah. And I think that for me too, it's when I first came home from Danbury, I was gung-ho. I wanted to change the system. I was an advocate going to rallies. And then I realized, wow, to change the system, you need to really educate the people, the young kids that are in college that are going to be senators and they're going to be political, you know, that's where you have to go. I don't think the system is going to change overnight. I think we have so much work to do. And it's so broken, but how to fix a system, everybody has their own idea of how to fix this crazy system. And for me, I do believe that at a federal camp level, to see these women try to raise their children in a camp, there's no reasoning for it. Because take Danbury, for instance, there's no lock. I've never been handcuffed. I've never been, never, ever in my, I've never been, you know, arrested in a police car or anything like that. I pled guilty. I waited. I walked myself into Danbury. I stayed there for 7 months. My kids and husband came every single weekend. And then I went home to a halfway house. Well, I went to a halfway house, which was 10 times worse than Danbury was. That was a prison. And, you know, you're transitioning along the way to home confinement. Home confinement was almost, it was tougher than Danbury. It was tougher. And I know women now because of COVID that because of the CARES Act are home on home confinement. They have ankle bracelets on. They're being checked up on consistently. But they feel they're productive. They're working. They're paying restitution. They're home with their children versus being a camp doing plumbing for the men's FCI all day long while your children are running rampant. It's insane to me.
Yeah. And that's, and again, that gets back to what are the goals as a society in criminal justice? What our goals for punishment are going to be? And just to elaborate a little bit, I mean, I think a phenomenal point about why it's so important, because this generation of future said, I think even more than I always, not because it's a shameless plug, but I always encourage even non-CJ majors to at least take intro to CJ. Yeah. I think that is so, because in my experience in the 20 years I've been doing this, the feedback that I get from my non-CJ majors about what they because they don't know. You watch NCIS, you watch Shawshank, you watch a couple. But to see, and my point is, we don't have to agree on, you know, our ideologies. As a matter of fact, I encourage you to just, as long as you can reasonably support your opinion, I am all about, you know, discussions and dialogue. But I think it's almost more important just as voters, as citizens, to be informed. I mean, and obviously at the level of, you know, people who are going into the field, absolutely the politicians and that's great. But as it just to be an informed citizen and to vote to make those, because those that's what's going to happen.
Yes.
You know, we talk about, you know, when we talk about mass incarceration, a lot of that just comes from the Senate, and that falls on Congress. Until Congress does, it's easy to blame the police, and it's easy to blame COs because it's they're a tangible group. But yeah, the real change comes from Congress. Once they change those laws, you know, to the point you talked about earlier, those inmates that I had who I felt really guilty that these guys got out and they were wrongfully convicted. I had nothing to do with their sentencing. But in some way, I felt a sense of guilt around. But again, those, you know, they were arrested by the police based on the laws established by Congress. They were sentenced by the laws established by Congress, and they were incarcerated under the specifications of Congress. Yeah. So until we change that, all this other discussion, in my opinion, is great, but it's not going to have the same impact until it changes. I'll change coming from the top.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I mean, I know a lot of women that inside they're constantly talking back or to the COs or have a lot to say. These COs in a camp, that's gotta be the worst job in the world. It's so boring. They sit there and I think they put the most out of shape guys in the camp. But they're nice guys. Yeah. You know, they sit there. It's kind of just a horror listening to these women cackle all day. And I hate saying that, but it's the truth. But I will say, I agree. And I don't know if you know this, my daughter graduated her master's degree from Albertus in criminal justice.
Exceptional student. I wasn't going to say anything until you did, but absolutely.
Yeah. And now today, and she's been on my podcast with my other daughter. I've had podcasts with, and she's been very involved and proactive. She is a paralegal for a criminal defense attorney.
Excellent. Great.
And doing phenomenal with that. And he hired her specifically because she understood on that side of things. And her entire viewpoint and voting politically has changed because of her time spending in criminal justice.
I think that's it. And again, that's like the best thing to hear. And again, as the kind of face of, or as the chair of the Department of Programs, I never want Albertus to be a cop school. We're not training people to be police officers. We are training individuals. We are hopefully teaching individuals to be informed citizens and critical thinkers. Mm-hmm. If they're going to go on to the PD will send them through a specific academy. The DOC will send them through a specific academy. But it's so great to hear that was the, because that makes all this worthwhile. The yeah. program is designed. And again, obviously, we all have our personal ideologies. I tend to lean a little more conservative, pro-law enforcement. But I So earlier about Professor Kendrick, we have very different ideological views, but we're able to work together. And that's the beauty for our undergraduate program. Someone who graduates with a bachelor's in criminal justice from Alberta has 72% of their credits come outside of criminal justice. So in a way, it's all, so for those individuals in other concentrations or fields who may be not so pro law enforcement, my thing is, here's your chance. You have these students in your, and that's, it's not about indoctrination. It's about exposing them to different views and theories and allowing them to make their own decisions. So to hear her experiences and her views on that is that I can't.
Yeah. And I will say, I am a huge fan. Albertus has been, and it's a plug for Albertus, because they have been so welcoming to me and so just wonderful. Home, feeling like I'm home. I wish I can continue there. And I said this to you, I wish they had a graduate level sociology. And I talked to Professor Kendrick about this, to go even further at Albertus.
Yep.
And they just don't at this time. But
as the interim chair, hopefully I can work it.
Yes, you definitely should, because I think I've taken all the criminal justice classes because they interact with sociology. And I just decided, after the last many years of listening and being the social work side of things, that's not for me. Exactly. Listening to people all day, where I don't have much patience. I don't work well with others, I should say. The research side, I've owned
the maturation process. I think we all go through that.
It really is. And then I didn't realize I've owned a title research company for 30 years. I should have realized research is where, research. Yeah, I could do that by myself. It's fascinating.
That's fantastic. And again, that's the whole point of the educational journey. I joke about it. When I was in undergrad, my undergrad was, I was political science with a concentration in pre-law. I took my LSATs. I applied to UVM. I was going to be an environmental lawyer. And some of my buddies were out one night. We're like, hey, we're going to take the DOC test tomorrow. I said, what's that? They said, it's work in the prison. Said, they're going to pay you $14.25 an hour benefits. And I said, yeah, I'll give it a shot. And so, we have all these great aspirations. And again, at 19 years old, we're all very enlightened, and you're going to save the world, but you kind of, to that point, it's a circuitous path, and all the experience, everything we pick up along the way just kind of get us to where we are. So I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, it is great. And to circle back to end our hour, I just hope that our listeners can understand and have a better respect for correctional officers as well as inmates. Yeah. We do come from very different perspectives, but really they're the same in some respect. I mean, they're the same.
Absolutely.
I think. And I think many people who have been inmates who have become successful with their inner side will agree with me and say that both sides have to work together. And I've seen many podcasts with correctional officers, good and bad, and wonderful. I think I sent a few to you.
Yes.
That were interesting. And I think most correctional officers feel the same way you do. There has to be a unity where, when you're coming out of prison, working together with correctional officers is a wonderful tool to help people and community.
I think that's fantastic. I can't thank you enough for this forum to kind of give my, and that's the thing, as we talked about. I think many times, more often than not, no matter what the situation, we have so many more similarities and differences. But and again, not to get into the whole culture of America today and the camps and the divisiveness. But I think if we can, and again, I think those are always kind of extremes. I think the majority of individuals fall somewhere in the middle. Yeah. So to the point earlier about the vote, if the largest mass of individuals are truly somewhere in the middle, then I think we can find ways to address these issues. If we can eliminate the loudest, most controversial voices on each side. And that was very diplomatic. And that's find some way in the middle. So again, I think this is tremendous. I can't thank you enough. I truly respect everything you're doing. And so hopefully individuals watching this agree with us. And this is one more way that we can, increase the dialogue.
Absolutely. And how does, if anyone has questions, how can they contact you?
You can email me. It's jnlowrie, L-A-W-R-I-E, @albertus.edu. I would, you know, be love to talk to anybody in any capacity. And like I said, I am always available. So.
Wonderful. And I do have to tell you before we go is the funny thing in our household is, I forget what movie it is. Mike Lowry, the
Bad Boys.
Every time the phone or if I'm talking to you, I hang up. I go, that was John Lowry.
So I can't tell you. I must have been. I'm going to say that movie came out in 95 or 96, the original. And I heard that for two, well, just walking down the tier, Mike Lowry, for 2 years, everywhere I went in that facility. So I can relate.
So yeah. So when our listeners are trying to find you, they can remember your last name that movie.
If you just Google my name, I'm the only person that looks like this. So yeah. So between the two, it's easy. I'm easy to find.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
I just want to give a little plug. If anybody wants a mug, they can write in and we send them for free. So I will send you one. So you
have one. I
appreciate
that. Thank you very much.
Great. And thank you all for watching, and we will again see you soon.